You're listening to The Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. Well, ladies and gentlemen, got off to a rough start tonight. For some reason, this CD player that we've had trouble with in the past didn't want to work right, and I don't know if it's going to work right for the rest of the broadcast. However, tonight should be very interesting for all of you. I'm going to try very hard to give you some ammunition. They tell us that there's no such thing. They tell us, ladies and gentlemen, that there's no such thing as a new world order. And I'm going to tell you right now, that is a blatant, barefaced lie. And I'm going to prove it with quotes and documentation tonight for 2 hours, or as long as I have material, you're going to hear this information. And the next time somebody tells you there is no such thing, you just take that tape, make a copy, and give it to them and say, listen to this. And by golly, if they listen to it, their whole outlook on the world is going to change. And there really won't be anything that they can do about it. It's just going to change. So, I'll be right back after this short pause. Idea what this CD player is playing. In fact, I'm going to take all these discs out and start all over again because this is incredible. Something obviously got placed in the wrong slot. Okay, that one's right. Just let me take a minute here and see if I can figure out what's going on. Okay. No wonder. Should go there. But that still doesn't account for a couple of things that have been happening here. Let's try it again and see what happens. Oh boy. Now, you see, that's the one that I just did. And something shouldn't be here. Something should not be here. That's okay. I think, really, what has happened is there's something in one of these cases. What I'm using is Telarc, which is a special label made so that anybody can use it without having to get special permission or anything like that. And I was trying that out tonight, and apparently what it says is in the case is not actually what's in the case. So we'll just skip that. We'll go right into the beginning of our programming for tonight. Now listen very carefully, ladies and gentlemen. I believe that this is very important information. I think it's going to give you ammunition when you're talking to the dunderheads. Now I can either go forward from history, or I can start at the current time and go backward. And I think what I'll do is just start in history and go forward, and this is going to take quite some time. And we'll begin in 1776 with a quote by Adam Weishaupt, who was the founder of the Bavarian branch of the Illuminati. There were many more than one branch. He was the first person who brought the Illuminati, or the Illumined Ones, out into the public light, so to speak. They're always seeking more light, you know. And he said this, quote, "It is necessary to establish a universal regime and empire over the whole world," end quote. And that's from Conspiracy Against God and Man, written by Reverend Clarence Kelly, Western Islands, Appleton, Wisconsin, 1974, page 200. In 1776, Adam Weishaupt also said this, quote, "Diminish patriotism, then men will learn to know each other again as such, and the bond of union will widen out. Nations shall vanish from the earth," end quote. In 1780, Adam Weishaupt said this, quote, "Nothing can bring this about, the New World Order, but hidden societies. Hidden schools of wisdom are the means which will one day free men from their bonds. Princes and nations shall vanish from the earth," end quote. That's from John Robison's Proofs of a Conspiracy, Western Islands, Appleton, Wisconsin. That was originally published in 1798, and it can be found on page 91. In 1798, also, the Illuminati leaders would, quote, "rule the world with uncontrollable power, while all the rest will be employed as mere tools of the ambition of their unknown superiors," end quote. That's also from John Robison's Proofs of a Conspiracy, Western Islands, Appleton, Wisconsin, 1798, page 8. And in 1844, Benjamin Disraeli, from his novel Coningsby, or The New Generation, printed in 1844. Benjamin Disraeli was the Prime Minister of Great Britain. Quote, "So you see, the world is governed by very different personages from what is imagined by those who are not behind the scenes," end quote. In 1848, Karl Marx wrote this in the Communist Manifesto in 1848, page 23. Quote, "The communists are further reproached with desiring to abolish countries and nationalities," end quote. In 1850, Abraham Lincoln said this, quote, "I see in the near future a crisis approaching that unnerves me and causes me to tremble for the safety of my country. Corporations have been enthroned. An era of corruption in high places will follow, and the money power of the country will endeavor to prolong its reign by working upon the prejudices of the people until the wealth is aggregated in a few hands and the republic is destroyed," end quote. From Dallas Plemons, The Illuminati, Self-Published Tracts, 1979, page 4. In 1913, President Wilson said this in his book, The New Freedom, and I quote, "Some of the biggest men in the United States in the field of commerce and manufacture are afraid of something. They know that there is a power somewhere so organized, so subtle, so watchful, so interlocked, so complete, so pervasive, that they had better not speak above their breath when they speak in condemnation of it," end quote. That's also, that quote is also included in Theodore White's The Making of the President, 1964, New York, Athenaeum, 1965, page 67. In 1920, Winston Churchill said this, quote, "From the days of Spartacus, Weishaupt, to those of Karl Marx, to those of Trotsky, this worldwide conspiracy for the overthrow of civilization has been steadily growing," end quote. That's from the Illustrated Sunday Herald, February the 8th, 1920. And in 1922, Charles W. Eliot said this, quote, "Our government should enter heartily into the existing League of Nations," end quote, from the Next American Contribution to Civilization, printed in Foreign Affairs, the Journal of the Council on Foreign Relations, September 15, 1922, page 65. In 1928, Charles P. Howland said this in Survey of American Foreign Relations in 1928, published for the Council on Foreign Relations, New Haven, Yale University Press, 1928, page 236. And I quote, "As early as the autumn of 1914, Wilson said, when looking ahead to the end of the war, all nations must be absorbed into some great association of nations. When Wilson was persuaded to speak at the League to Enforce Peace banquet in Washington on May 27, 1916, he endorsed the program of that organization only indirectly, making no mention of force. But he advocated the general idea of a League with such ardor that he was henceforth regarded as its champion." End quote. In 1929, quote, "The leaders of America's new secret society, the Council on Foreign Relations, engineered the great crash of 1929, end quote. That's William T. Still from the book The New World Order, The Ancient Plan of Secret Societies, Lafayette, Louisiana, Huntington House Publishers, 1990, page 158. 1929, Louis T. McFadden, chairman of the House Banking Committee, said this, quote, "It was not accidental. It was a carefully contrived occurrence. The international bankers sought to bring about a condition of despair here so that they might emerge as rulers of us all," end quote. James Perloff, The Shadows of Power, The Council on Foreign Relations and the American Decline, Appleton, Wisconsin, Western Islands, 1988, page 56. In 1933, in the public laws of the 73rd Congress of the United States of America, June 17, 1933, paragraph B. "During the time of war, or during any other period of national emergency declared by the President may, through any agency that he may designate, or otherwise investigate, regulate, or prohibit, under such rules and regulations as he may prescribe, by means of licenses or otherwise, any transactions in foreign exchange, transfers of credit between or payments by banking institutions as defined by the President, and export, hoarding, melting, or earmarking of gold or silver coin or bullion or currency by any person within the United States or any place subject to the jurisdiction thereof, and the President may require any person engaged in any transaction referred to in this subdivision to furnish under oath complete information relative thereto, including the production of any books of account, contracts, letters, or other papers in connection therewith in the custody or control of such person, either before or after such transaction is completed." 1933, quote, "We deplore the division of humankind on nationalistic grounds. The best option is to transcend the limits of national sovereignty and to move toward the building of a world community in which all sections of the human family can participate. Thus, we look to the development of a system of world law and a world order based upon transnational federal government," end quote. Paul Kurtz in the Humanist Manifestos 1 and 2, Prometheus Books, Buffalo, New York, 1933 and 1973, page 21. Mr. McGugin in the Congressional Record of the House on pages 81 through 82 said this in 1933, quote, "If we start out printing currency without regard for the gold reserve, then in the end, when we find that excessive inflation destroys the country and the people, we shall try to get back to the gold standard. Then we shall find that we have so much currency outstanding that we cannot tie it to our limited supply of gold, except by reducing the content of the gold dollar in proportion to the increased amount of currency. That may mean that we shall have to decrease the gold content 50%, maybe 75%, and maybe 90%. It will all depend upon how far we carry the inflation during the period that our currency is not tied to gold. It may be that we shall do as Germany did by going so far that there is no possibility of tying all of our outstanding currency to gold, and we shall be obliged to repudiate and cancel some of our currency. Anyone knows that this government cannot now collect enough taxes to meet its present expenses. Whenever governments reach the position where they can neither collect enough taxes to meet their expenses nor borrow enough to meet their expenses, there is only one thing left for them, and that is to print money. Such is the position of the United States, and whether we like it or not, there's going to be some inflation in order to meet the obligations of the government. In 1933, Mr. Wright Patman said this in the Congressional Record of the House, March 9, 1933, on page 82, and I quote, "The President submitted a bill which was intended to assist in the opening of all the banks in the nation, although it was contrary to many of the principles that I have advocated for many years. It contained provisions I do not approve and failed to go far enough on other ways. I yielded and voted for the bill. It was an emergency measure and should have been passed immediately. The proposal embodied one feature that I have advocated for a long time, and that was the issuance of additional circulating medium. The banks of the nation have inflated credit out of the proportion to the amount of actual money. The result is the banks have become indebted to their depositors to the extent of $45 billion and have in their vaults less than $1 billion to pay it with. The new law will cause the printing presses at the Bureau of Engraving and Printing here in Washington to print more money and furnish it to the banks." In 1933, Title 18, United States Code, Banks and Banking, Section 95A, page 193. Quote, "On March 5, 1933, President Roosevelt relied on Section 5, small b, of the Trading with the Enemy Act as authority for his Proclamation 2039, which closed all banks for 5 days. This was clearly a time of financial crises, not of war, and hence was not within the literal terms and purposes of the Act." Also in 1933, in the public papers of the Presidents of the United States, Washington, D.C., United States Government Printing Office, 1977, page 1689, I quote, "Now, therefore, I, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, President of the United States of America, in view of such national emergency and by virtue of the authority vested in me by said act, and in order to prevent the export, hoarding, or earmarking of gold or silver coin or bullion or currency, do hereby proclaim, order, direct, and declare that from Monday the 6th day of March to Thursday the 9th day of March, 1933, both dates inclusive, there shall be maintained and observed by all banking institutions and all branches thereof located in the United States of America, including the territories and insular possessions, a bank holiday, and that during said period all banking transactions shall be suspended. During such holiday, excepting as hereinafter provided, no such banking institution or branch shall pay out, export, earmark, or permit the withdrawal or transfer in any manner or by any device whatsoever of any gold or silver coin or bullion or currency, or take any other action which might facilitate the hoarding thereof, make loans or discounts, deal in foreign exchange, transfers, credits from the United States or to any place abroad, or transact any other banking business whatsoever." In 1935, in the annual message to the Congress, January 4, 1935, quote, "We have undertaken a new order of things, yet we progress to it under the framework and in the spirit and intent of the American Constitution. We have proceeded throughout the nation a measurable distance on the road to this new order," end quote. That was stated by President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. In 1940, Reinhold Niebuhr, Lewis Mumford et al., in The City of Man, a Declaration on World Democracy, printed in New York Viking Press, 1940, on page 25, said this, quote, "New order, where all states deflated and disciplined must align themselves under the law of the world state," end quote. In 1942, Adolf Hitler said this, quote, National Socialism will use its own revolution for the establishing of a new world order, end quote. That was found in The Occult and the Third Reich by Jean Michael Angerbert, printed by McGraw-Hill Book Company, New York, 1971, on page 155. In 1942, Earl Browder, in Victory and After, New York, International Publishers, 1942, page 169, Earl Browder was the General Secretary of the Communist Party in the United States of America, said this, quote, "It can be said without exaggeration that ever closer relations between our nation and the Soviet Union are an unconditional requirement for the United Nations as a world coalition," end quote. In 1944, Manly P. Hall, in his book, The Secret Destiny of America, Los Angeles, The Philosophical Research Society, Incorporated, 1944, 4th printing, 1978, on page 72, said this, quote, "For more than 3,000 years, secret societies have labored to create the background of knowledge necessary to the establishment of an enlightened democracy among the nations of the world," end quote. In 1945, the Communist Party, USA, April 1945, edition of Political Affairs, which was their official theoretical journal, wrote this, quote, "Great popular support and enthusiasm for the United Nations policy should be built up, well organized, and fully articulate. But it is also necessary to do more than that. The opposition must be rendered so impotent that it will be unable to gather any significant support in the Senate against the United Nations Charter and the treaties which will follow," end quote. In 1945, printed in Congress and the Nation, A Review of Government and Politics in the Post-War Years, Congressional Quarterly Service, Washington, D.C., 1965, on page 98, we found this, quote, "In adhering to the United Nations Charter in 1945, the United States had also accepted membership in the International Court of Justice." In 1945, also printed in Congress and the Nation, A Review of Government and Politics in the Post-War Years, Congressional Quarterly Service, Washington, D.C., 1965, on page 96, we found this, quote, "Establishment of UNRRA was followed by agreement by the UN Monetary and Financial Conference at Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, July 22, 1944, to create two new institutions, an International Monetary Fund and an International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, each to be run by a board of governors representing member nations whose voting power was scaled to their capital contributions. U.S. participation in IMF and IBRD was approved by Congress in 1945, end quote. Also in 1945, and also in Congress and the Nation, A Review of Government and Politics in the Post-War Years, Congressional Quarterly Service, Washington, D.C., 1965, page 96, we found this, quote, "The proposed successor to the League of Nations was to consist of a 11-member Security Council on which the United States, Britain, Russia, China, and France would hold permanent seats, and a General Assembly in which each UN member would have one vote. Virtually all power was to reside in the Security Council, which might call on members to furnish military forces, if necessary, to maintain or restore international peace and security," end quote. Provision was made for a Secretary General, an Economic and Social Council, a Military Staff Committee, and an International Court of Justice. Also in 1945, from the same document, Congressional Quarterly Service, Washington, D.C., 1965, on page 97, quote, "Public discussion of the Charter was intense and widespread before and during the two-month conference at which Vandenberg and Dulles played leading roles. At its conclusion, June 26, President Truman acclaimed the Charter as a declaration of faith that war is not inevitable. In a personal appearance before the Senate, July 2, he called for prompt ratification of the Charter and the annexed statute of the International Court of Justice. Said Truman, the choice is not between this charter and no charter at all," end quote. 1946, on July the 14th, in Congress and the Nation, a review of government and politics in the post-war years, Congressional Quarterly Service, Washington, D.C., 1965, page 143, 1946, July 14th, I quote, Senate consented to ratification of the U.N. Charter by a vote of 89-2. Debate centered on Article 43, pledging member nations to detail armed forces to the Security Council for peacekeeping use. Some senators feared this would delegate the war-making powers of Congress, but President Truman said that any decision to commit U.S. troops would be submitted to Congress for approval. In 1946, Alan W. Dulles, the Council of Foreign Relations, and Beatrice Pitney Lamb in Foreign Policy Association, 1946, said this, quote, There is no indication that American public opinion, for example, would approve the establishment of a superstate or permit American membership in it. In other words, time, a long time, will be needed before world government is politically feasible. This time element might seemingly be shortened so far as American opinion is concerned by an active propaganda campaign in this country. Alan W. Dulles and Beatrice Pitney Lamb, United Nations Booklet, Headlines Series, number 59, New York, the Foreign Policy Association, September-October edition, 1946, pages 44 and 86. In 1947, in Congress and the Nation, a review of government and politics in the post-war years, Congressional Quarterly Service, Washington, D.C., 1965, page 188, quote, The General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, signed in Geneva on October 30, 1947, by 23 countries, consisted of a complex set of principles and rules respecting tariff and non-tariff barriers to trade, end quote. And I bet you all thought that GATT was brand new. Not on your life. 1947, in Congress and the Nation, a review of government and politics in the post-war years, Congressional Quarterly Service, Washington, D.C., 1965, page 249. We find this. It was the purpose of the National Security Act, the law declared, to provide a comprehensive program for the future security of the United States and to give the three services authoritative coordination and unified direction under civilian control, but not to merge them. The law created a national military establishment headed by Secretary of Defense and consisting of departments of the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force, end quote. In 1949, also, Congress and the Nation, a review of government and politics in the post-war years, Congressional Quarterly Service, Washington, D.C., 1965, page 468, Quote, public housing was the focal point of controversy in the years before and after the passage of the Housing Act of 1949. Many conservatives called it socialism. It was symbolic of the welfare state. Real estate dealers and landlords resented the intrusion of the federal government working with local authorities. In 1949, in the Senate Concurrent Resolution 66, first introduced in the Senate on September 13, 1949, by Senator Glenn Taylor, Democrat of Idaho, quoted by Dennis L. Cuddy in the New World Order, a critique and chronology, a pamphlet, Source 1, continued, Milford, Pennsylvania, America's Future, Incorporated, 1992, on page 10, quote, The present charter of the United Nations should be changed to provide a true world government constitution, end quote. In 1950, Des Griffin wrote in Descent into Slavery, South Pasadena, California, Emissary Publications, 1980, page 214, and William T. Still also wrote in his book New World Order, The Ancient Plan of Secret Societies, Lafayette, Louisiana, Huntington House Publishers, 1990, page 174, I quote, As banker James Warburg, the son of Council on Foreign Relations founder Paul Warburg, confidently told the United States Senate on February 17, 1950, We shall have world government whether or not we like it. The only question is whether world government will be achieved by conquest or consent, end quote. In 1950s, Department of State Publication 3929, an International Organization and Conference Series 3, 52, page 4, we find this quote. The United Nations is a true world organization. Actually, the creation of a world government in any shape or form depends not primarily upon the structure of an international organization, but upon the willingness of key countries to surrender certain sovereign rights." End quote. In 1950, James Warburg, in The West in Crisis, Garden City, New York, Doubleday and Company, Incorporated, New York, 1959, on page 30, and also William F. Jasper, Global Tyranny, Step by Step, and Appleton, Wisconsin, Western Islands, 1992, page 89, both of them, quote, "A world order without world law is an anachronism, and that, since war now means the extinction of civilization, a world which fails to establish the rule of law over the nation states cannot long continue to exist. We are living in a perilous period of transition from the era of the fully sovereign nation state to the era of world government." Oh my goodness. I just don't know what to say about all this, ladies and gentlemen, because it's incredible. So, you think about what you just heard, and I'll be right back to talk to you about our sponsor, Swiss America Trading, and then we'll do some other things. The Time is brought to you by Swiss America Trading, who specialize in non-confiscatable, non-reportable hard assets. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm talking about metal, precious metal, gold and silver, in all of its various forms. But real money is gold and silver coins. Specifically in the law, a dollar is a specific weight and measurement of purity of silver coin. Money can also be an equivalent value of gold coin. The Constitution says no state shall tender in payment of debt anything other than gold or silver coin. Are you beginning to get the message? We have been robbed, and I mean literally, have the rug, the nation, the land, the property, everything ripped right out from under us while we sat sleeping. And the money has been so inflated over the years. Nothing. Nothing is valued as it should be. And as the paper continues to inflate and people continue to borrow and foreclosures continue to be made, the nation continues to be stolen right out from under us. And if you can't grasp that, you need to sit down and think about it for a while. Why is it you have a warrant deed or a warranty deed on your home when you pay it off instead of the actual patent title? You see, a warrant deed just guarantees that somebody owns the house, but it's not you. Why is it that when you purchase an automobile and pay it off, whether you pay cash when you buy it or you pay it off with payments, when you finally get what you think gives you the ownership of that vehicle, it says, and yes, for those of you who are in the common law movement, I mean to use the term vehicle, because that's what all of these people out there believe that it is. It puts them in a special status. Why is it you get a certificate of title instead of the actual title of ownership? It's because, ladies and gentlemen, you don't own it. The state retains the title, and the state retains the ownership of the vehicle because you never paid for it with real money. Wow. You see, as long as you use their phony currency, you're in their phony trap. And over the years, eventually, they end up with everything, and you, well, take a good look again at the Washington Monument. What you get is the shaft. Call Swiss America Trading, 1-800-289-2646, and get your hands on some real money. I love it when people trade in real money. I just got a letter or a fax, I can't remember which. Because I went through so many letters and so many faxes today. Somebody wants to buy the satellite system with gold coin or silver coin, and they want to know how to ship it. That's wonderful. 1-800-289-2646. Get yourself in gear, folks. You need to get your hands on some real money. It's going to be your only protection. You need something for spiritual. You need something for physical. And you need something for economic protection. Real money is your only economic protection. Guns and bullets are your physical protection. And whatever your source of spiritual nourishment is, make sure that you've got that also. 1-800-289-2646. Do it now. The king is coming. And he's not making it any secret.
I'm gonna be a mighty king, enemies beware.
Well, I've never seen a king on beast with quite so little hair.
I'm gonna be the main event, the king was before. I'm pushing up, I'm looking down, I'm working on my board.
An inspiring thing.
Oh, I just can't wait to be king.
You've gone the wrong way to get your heart, but if you think.
No one's saying Tuesday.
Now, when I said that,
no one's saying be there. No one's saying stop that. No one's saying be here.
Now, be
here. We go run around all day.
Well, that's definitely our way.
If you miss the point of all this, go see the movie. If you see the movie and you still miss the point of all of this, you need an education in symbology. In 1950, Harry Truman, remember he was a president of the United States, the 33rd, he said this in our foreign policy, a Department of State publication, 3972 on page 4, quote, "There is no longer any real distinction between domestic and foreign affairs," end quote. In 1950, Harry Truman said this in Our Foreign Policy, a Department of State publication, 3972, on page 16, quote, "To that end, they began to plan and build an international community in which people could live in peace under the protection of law. The building of such a community is the most ambitious, the most difficult, the most hopeful, and the most exciting enterprise on which the American people have ever embarked. It is big enough and hard enough to engage all our energies. If it were not for the threat of aggression, we could concentrate all our energies on that job. We could say that it was, in fact, the substance of our foreign policy," end quote. In 1950, Harry Truman, in Our Foreign Policy, Department of State publication, 3972 on page 18, also said this, quote, "To this end, we have helped to write an international charter of fair trade practices and to create an international trade organization where the nations can settle disputes across a conference table. Through reciprocal trade and tariff agreements, we are gradually opening up the channels of world trade that have been clogged for a generation. All this is only the bare outline of an international community. Nobody can predict where the experiment will lead or how long it will take. It may in time lead to the international control of all armament, which is essential. It may lead eventually to a form of world government, which is a possibility that excites the imagination of some adventurous people," end quote. You never knew that Harry Truman was a traitor, did you? Well, he was. And Americans who lived during his time knew it. And that's why they vilified him. And that's why the socialist communists that are in control now are trying to resurrect Harry Truman as some kind of great American hero. In 1950, Harry Truman, in our Foreign Policy, Department of State, publication 3972, page 28, also said this, quote, "To transform the pioneer international society of today into an orderly community of free nations, that is our long-range purpose. The community idea is thousands of years old in the mind of man, but it is just being born in the minds of nations. To bring an international community into existence may be the work of generations, but we have made a beginning. Sheer necessity might hurry up the process. A community has to have both a political and an economic basis. Even more important, it has to have a moral basis. Certain fundamental standards of decency and behavior have to be understood and accepted by the majority of its members before you can have a successful community. The majority must not only uphold those standards, but insist upon their being upheld. What has been called a consensus of moral judgment is the foundation of law and order and the beginning of real community life. 5 years ago, we helped to create a great testing ground for the community idea, the United Nations," end quote. Oh my, this is incredible. I just can't stand it, ladies and gentlemen. I've got so much more to read to you. Just pages and 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 pages. And it doesn't stop. It just doesn't stop. And, see? It keeps going and going and going, like that little guy. Just got the battery. You know who he is, don't you? The little fellow. Who, we call that the Duracell rabbit. Is that what he is? The Duracell rabbit. I'm attempting once more to get the CDs ready for the network ID at the top of the hour, and I hope that it goes okay this time. However, it doesn't look like it. It just doesn't look like it. Something's missing again. Where is it? What's missing? Something is not here. And it's here. Oh, thank goodness. Nope, that's not it. That's not it either. Something is really wrong here, folks. Oh, okay. I found it. Sorry to put you through this, but occasionally things get mixed up. And when they do, they get really mixed up. If you don't believe me, take a look around at the world. Take a look around at your own family. Take a look at your neighborhood. Take a look at your city and your state. You'll see exactly what I mean. Everything is all mixed up. In 1950, Harry Truman said this in our Foreign Policy, Department of State, publication 3972, page 30. And I quote, "The United Nations has no lawmaking powers. It has no enforcement powers. The charter did not contemplate an international police force but it did provide that the Security Council should have military forces in the form of national contingents at its disposal. All United Nations members said the charter were to contribute contingents by agreement with the Security Council, end quote. Also in 1950, Harry Truman, in our Foreign Policy Department of State publication 3972, pages 73 and 74, said this, quote, "We must embark," said Mr. Truman, "on a bold new program for making the benefits of our scientific advances and industrial progress available for the improvement and growth of underdeveloped areas. We should make available to peace-loving peoples the benefits of our store of technical knowledge in order to help them realize their aspirations for a better life. And in cooperation with other free nations, we should foster capital investment in areas needing development. Our aim should be to help the free peoples of the world through their own efforts to produce more food, more clothing, more materials for housing, and more mechanical power to lighten their burdens." In the same publication, pages 88 to 89, Harry Truman said this, quote, "A free country is one that does not have to take orders from a foreign government. The fact that we help a country to be free of foreign domination does not mean that we support the particular government it happens to have at any particular time. It means that we want the kind of international community in which each nation is free to manage its own affairs, subject, of course, to its pledges and responsibilities under the United Nations Charter. Within the broad area of the Charter, there is plenty of room for people to experiment and to change their forms of government if they wish, plenty of room for progress towards democracy." Remember what V.I. Lenin said, ladies and gentlemen? Democracy is indispensable to socialism. And that is where Harry Truman was taking us. 1950. In the same publication on page 97, Harry Truman said, quote, "The United Nations Charter pledged all its signers to respect and promote human rights and fundamental freedoms, but it did not define those rights and freedoms. One of the first tasks of the United Nations, therefore, was to get general agreement among its members on what those words meant. To be realistic, such an agreement would have to express the honest beliefs and aims of all the nations that put their names to it. It must, in short, be a common denominator of conviction rather than a pious hope," end quote. 1950, the same publication on page 99, Harry Truman said, quote, "Today the foreign policy of the United States is a declaration of the interdependence of men and nations," end quote. In 1950, John Foster Dulles, in War or Peace, New York, Macmillan, 1950, on page 40, said this, quote, "John Foster Dulles, Counsel on Foreign Relations, who would become President Eisenhower's first Secretary of State, quote, "The United Nations represents not a final stage in the development of world order, but only a primitive stage. Therefore, its primary task is to create the conditions which will make possible a more highly developed organization," end quote. 1952, in an editorial, The Climate of Freedom, in the Saturday Review of July 19, 1952, on page 22, it says, quote, "If UNESCO is attacked on the grounds that it is helping to prepare the world's peoples for world government, then it is an error to burst forth with apologetic statements and denials. Let us face it, the job of UNESCO is to help create and promote the elements of world citizenship. When faced with such a charge, let us by all means affirm it from the housetops," end quote. In 1953, quote, "To Americans, their freedoms seem indestructible because they have not known a national life without it. They are prone to think their liberty cannot be taken away. It is in the proposed United Nations Covenant on Human Rights, which is favored by the State Department under the Truman administration, and which in its final form will come before the United States Senate for ratification as a treaty. The danger to the freedom of the American people is the danger which confronts our Constitution in general, stemming from a loophole in the Constitution by which the United Nations Charter, having been ratified by the Senate as a treaty, may be held to supersede the Constitution. The Bill of Rights in our Constitution protects the people against any abridgment of freedom of the press and freedom of religion. It guarantees them trial by jury, protects their property from seizure without due process of law, and shields them from cruel and inhuman punishments. Let us look at a few examples of how the Bill of Rights and the proposed UN Covenant on Human Rights would be in conflict. The Bill of Rights says, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. But if the United Nations Covenant were to become our supreme law by treaty, here is what freedom of religion would mean to the more than 450 faiths in America today. And this is from the UN Covenant. Freedom to manifest one's religion or beliefs shall be subject only to such limitations as are pursuant to law and are reasonable and necessary to protect public safety, order, morals, or the fundamental rights of others. But the UN Covenant reads, the right to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas carries with it special duties and responsibilities and may therefore be subject to certain penalties, liabilities, and restrictions. But these shall be such only as are provided by law and necessary for the protection of national security, public order, safety, health, or morals, or of the rights, freedoms, and reputation of others. But the Constitution should be amended now to forestall a loss of freedom to our children and to oncoming generations through the power of treaties and executive agreements designed to circumvent the Constitution. We should be at least as concerned about the freedom of our posterity as were our forefathers who insisted on a Bill of Rights. That was written by the Honorable John W. Bricker of Ohio in H.R. Congressional Records, Appendix, January 9, 1953. Pages A62 to 63. 1953. Giuseppe Antonio Borghese of the Foundations of the World Republic, Chicago, University of Chicago Press, 1953. Inside flap of Dust Jacket, William F. Jasper, Global Tyranny, Step by Step, Appleton, Wisconsin, Western Islands, 1992, page 88. Both of these contain the same quote. World government, asserts Mr. Borghese, is inevitable. It will be born in one of two ways. It may come as a world empire with mass enslavement imposed by the victor of World War III, or it may take the form of a world federal republic established by gradual integration of the United Nations. End quote. In 1954, the Honorable Usher L. Burdick of North Dakota, in H.R. Congressional Record House, April 12th, page 5065, said this, quote, the dictionary defines genocide as the systematic destruction of a racial, political, or cultural group of people. Very few people in this world can be found who would not be in favor of putting a stop to this barbarous practice, but in framing this convention, the United Nations used this great appeal as an instrument to shield its real purpose. In defining genocide, the United Nations has gone beyond all past understanding of its meaning, and under the terms as this organization interprets it, if anyone anywhere even makes a statement reflecting upon any group or a member of any group which has the effect of injuring their feelings, then a crime has been committed, and the persons or person making the statement are ipso facto guilty of the crime of genocide. Knowing full well that such a law could not be enforced in the United States, the United Nations has made elaborate preparations to implement it. First of all, the interpretation of this law and trials conducted under it are not entrusted to the courts of this or any other country, but come under the jurisdiction of a court of its own, which the United Nations has set up, an international court of justice which has civil and criminal jurisdiction. For several years now, lawyers have been working on the construction of this code, and under it, a person charged with the offense of genocide is tried wherever the United Nations may decide. The alleged offender can be taken out of this country if here is where he uttered the statements that hurt the feeling of some group or a member of a group, and sent to any country the United Nations deems proper for trial. When he is tried, and it may be for his life, he does not have the protection of the Constitution and the laws of the United States, but he is subject to the United Nations Code of Law and its Constitution. The Covenant of Human Rights is another example. It sounds well on the face of it, but immediately it attacks the Constitution of the United States. The very charter of the United Nations does the same thing. The United Nations is not an organization to preserve peace, but a sinister attempt to form a world government with a House and Senate, a judicial system, a tax system, and a police system. In 1955, the Honorable Lawrence H. Smith said in the Congressional Record of May 4, 1955, pages A3016 to 3017, quote, "At the second London Parliamentary Conference on World Government, foreign world government groups in collaboration with the United World Federalists, Incorporated, drew up Plan A and Plan B for transforming the United Nations into a world government. Plan A stipulates that membership should be open to all states of the world and all must be urged to join. This would include all the communist nations. The UWF would have us join with the enemy in a worldwide socialistic organization to preserve liberties which he is unalterably committed to destroy, even when he has candidly admitted that this is easiest of accomplishment by putting the free nations to join with him in just such a coalition. Once membership has been accepted, continued membership must be compulsory. There must be no right of succession. If our enemies chose to vote our freedoms down the drain, we couldn't even shoot our way out, as a provision of disarmament precludes the possibility. And what a notorious repudiation of our Declaration of Independence. That great document states that when any government becomes destructive of man's unalienable rights, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government. That this plan and Plan B, which is only slightly less radical and for which they will press if Plan A fails to get the necessary UN support, threatens the continued existence of our constitutional republic goes without saying. For as the law now stands, a treaty supersedes our Constitution, and the UN Charter is a treaty." This is the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network. We now return you to the Hour of the Time.
Light out for the purpose of your body and soul.